Okay, well, good morning, everyone. I'm Rob Atkinson, I'm president of ITIF, and I want to welcome you to an event, a really, really great event today with just an incredibly distinguished panel to talk about engineering as a discipline in the U.S., the future of engineering, why it's so important to America's economic future, and what are the kinds of changes, if any, do we need to be thinking about in terms of public policy. You know, I am not an engineer, but I was reading a short summary. There was a report back in 1955 by the NSF actually funded it, of leading engineers, and it was about the future of engineering in America. And it was reprinted in the Journal of Engineering Education. And I want to share one quote with you because I thought it was such a perfect quote, even though it was written over 50 years ago. It really, really crystallizes why engineering is so important. And it said, quote, "Engineering is far from static, for it is essentially a creative profession. It has played a dominant role in building American industrial superiority, in developing the principle of mass production, in giving the American people their high standard of living." And that is true today as it was true back then. But I think we have some serious challenges today in the United States. Unfortunately, at least in our view, it's unfortunate. We have more students graduating today with sports exercise math degrees than we do engineering degrees. We have more kids taking art history AP tests than we do computer science AP tests. Increasingly, the extent we do graduate engineering degrees, they're foreign-born, which is not a problem, except that increasingly foreign-born students are going back to their country and not staying here and providing their talent. So the other last thing I'll say before I introduce our speakers is we've been doing a lot of work in the last 2 years in particular on U.S. competitiveness, U.S. manufacturing in particular. In our view, one of the reasons we have not done as well in manufacturing, in fact, our analysis suggests that we lost about 10% of manufacturing output in the 2000s. This is unprecedented in American history. It never, ever happened where we were producing less at the beginning of at the end of a decade than at the beginning of the decade. And one reason is that I think the U.S. is still the predominant leader in science. Our real sweet spot is science-based entrepreneurship. We do good science, and we translate it into new companies better than any other country in the world, certainly a lot better than Germany. But what we don't do as well as Germany or Japan or Korea or Sweden is take knowledge and translate that into new product, into production. In other words, science is basically a global public good. It's easily appropriable. Engineering is not. Engineering is the capability you have domestically. So our analysis suggested that the U.S., sure, it needs to dramatically expand science support, but it also needs to become more of an engineering culture and an engineering economy. So today we have four great speakers to really address some of these points. I'm going to start with, we'll go in this order. I'll start in introduction with Dan Moat, who's the president of the National Academy of Engineering. He's also a Regents Professor on leave from University of Maryland. Dr. Moat received his BS, MS, and PhD degrees at UC Berkeley in mechanical engineering, and then joined the faculty there and taught mechanical engineering for 31 years. Then in 1998, he came and was the president of the University of Maryland, where the position he held until 2010. He's also served on the National Research Council Governing Board Executive Committee since 2009, chaired the NRC Committee on Global Science and Technology Strategies, co-chaired the Academy's Government Industry University Industry Research Roundtable, and a number of other distinguished positions, and also was on the NRC Committee with the Rising Above the Gathering Storm report that we all have seen and appreciated. Pramod Krugman, I'm sorry, I'm just butchering that. So, as the assistant director for the engineering director at NSF, so leads the NSF efforts on engineering, which is an $800 million budget. He's been in that position just about half a year now, March 2013. His research interests are centered on theory and applications of systems and control. He received his Bachelor's of Technology degree in electrical engineering from the Indian Institute of Technology, and then his PhD in electrical engineering from the University of Florida. He's held faculty positions at Florida, University of Minnesota, and University of Michigan. He also was the Deputy Director of Technology at ARPA-E in the Department of Energy, and had been a member of the IEEE Control Systems Theory and Robust Control Technical Committees. Helmuth Ludwig is the President, CEO of Siemens Industry North America. And I think it's really fitting to have a representative from a German company here, because I really think the Germans, if they get one thing right, it's engineering.
Even if you're not that good in science.
Pardon me?
Even if you're not that good in science.
You're not that good in science. You're pikers in science when it comes to engineering. I didn't say that, by the way. I just said you're really good at engineering. And in that capacity, he is responsible for all business activity and executive management of Siemens Industry business in North America and Central America. He joined Siemens in 1990. He served in a wide variety of positions all around the world, general manager in their facility or their business in Kazakhstan. He joined the Automation and Drives Group in Germany. He also was heading up Siemens Energy in Buenos Aires. Then he moved to the Systems Engineering Business Unit before being president of Siemens in North America. He holds a master's degree in industrial engineering from University of Karlsruhe in Germany, a master's of business administration, University of Chicago, and a doctorate, University of Kiel. And lastly, our colleague and friend Sridhar Kota, who we've had the real pleasure of working with for a number of years. Sridhar is the Herrick Professor of Engineering, University of Michigan, Ann Arbor. He's the author of over 200 technical papers on product design for manufacturability. He has over 25 patents. He's the recipient of the American Society of Mechanical Engineers Machine Design Award, the Leonardo da Vinci Award, the Outstanding Educator Award. He's also founded a company, Flexus Incorporated, and from 2009 to 2012 was the Assistant Director for Advanced Manufacturing in the White House Office of Science and Technology. So with that, we'll just start in this order, and we'll start with Dan.
Good. Thank you, Bob.
Well, thank you very much. It's really a great pleasure to be here and offer a few remarks for you. That's great. Thank you very much. I'll try to say a few things that other people won't say. Give you something different to think about what I think my colleagues are going to talk about very eloquently, by the way, and very importantly. So it's not that I don't think it's important. It's just I want to give you something else to think about. Clearly, rekindling ingenuity is a critical topic for any society, but especially one who depends on it for its future, like the United States. And ingenuity really cuts a very wide swath when you talk about it. It spans basic research, invention, development, manufacturing. It really spans everything that emanates from the mind, basically. It's a creative process. Now, a few basic ideas that are important for us to consider here. The federal outlay for research and development has been essentially 1% of GDP for 60 years. I mean, it's about, as dependable as your heartbeat. But currently, it's a little less than 0.8% GDP, the lowest in 40 years. Between 1987 and 2008, the investment in R&D grew at 0.3% per year over that period of time, where the GDP grew 3% per year over that time. So we're steadily disinvesting in research of all types in this country. R&D today is 11% of the discretionary budget of the federal government, where it was 17% in the 1960s. Even more alarming, actually, is the discretionary budget itself. Currently, it's 37% of the federal budget. In 10 years, it's projected to be 24% of the federal budget, dropped by one-third in 10 years. And the reason is interest on the debt and rising mandatory costs. So we have really some fundamental structural problems in our R&D enterprise in the country that are going to affect us, looks like, no matter what we do, but we have to be aware of them, and if we want to talk about policy issues, we should address these kind of fundamental structures as well. The other point is, of course, change is accelerating. We all know that. But I think we haven't quite come to grips with the spectacular rate of this change and also the secondary and tertiary consequences of it. As we know, in 2005, the U.S. had 5% of the global cell phone market. 5% in 2005. Today has 88%. Nokia was one of the biggest companies in the world in 2005. It's now disappeared. So in the IT business, you might say, well, this happens. This is a fast-moving, rapidly changing, new products, da-da-da-da, constantly. But also happens in traditional, very traditional and thought to be slow-moving enterprises. Take, for example, in 2009, the National Academy or the National Research Council published a report called America's Energy Future. And it tried to identify all the major issues in energy for policymakers to consider and put really facts and expert knowledge behind them. It was a great effort, very expensive, very skilled people. I mean, it was the best you could do at that time. 2009, it was published. That report did not mention the word fracking or hydraulic fracturing, not mentioned. In fact, its reflection on natural gas was that there was a lot of natural gas down there in those shales, but you couldn't get it economically, therefore it's not going to be a factor. Of course, that's changed entirely. In 4 years now, all of a sudden, fracking is going to save the energy picture of the United States. It's going to be the second largest source of energy supply for the country in 5 years. So change is accelerating, and it has lots of consequences to the workforce especially. Many people who do engineering do not identify themselves as engineers. Engineers and engineering are not a one-to-one association. This is something our profession has not considered. Engineers self-identify. I'm an engineer because I say so. But actually the practice, it doesn't depend on your self-identification. 25% of the members of the National Academy of Engineering have no degrees in engineering, by the way. The essence of engineering is creation. The essence of science is discovery. These are orthogonal to each other. There's no intersection between creation and discovery. It was put to me this way recently at a conference in England. This is for a five-year-old, so all the work for most of us. Science is taking what's out there and putting it in here. And engineering is taking what's in here and putting it out there. That pretty much summarizes the difference in the way we should think about it. I think we should not talk so much about the fact that engineering depends entirely on science, because it's in fact not even close to true. Engineering creates value for people and society using whatever is at hand, a lot of creativity, imagination, inspiration, some science, of course, where you've got it, some experience, some analysis, some intuition, some guesswork, just getting the job done. Engineering is much more than the transfer of science to value. Realization of economic value is a business question, of course, spanning many domains, currency, labor, trades, suppliers, material costs, etc., plus the product. But a quality engineering product is not sufficient for realizing economic value, as you know. In fact, it may not even be necessary in many cases. Now, universities, which was part of this conversation, are really central to promulgating ingenuity because they have all the assets necessary for this. All right? They have, of course, education, training, workforce development. They have research, discovery, creation, invention, IP. They have services, both to themselves, to communities, to governments, to industry, international services. They have had partnerships and collaborations locally, nationally, internationally. They have entrepreneurship, and they create enterprises themselves. They span all scales, individuals, organizations, regions, communities, states, nations, global. But universities cannot promote innovation and ingenuity maximally. They cannot do it. The reason is the mission of most universities conflicts with developing a committed culture of innovation. Differences are really embedded in the missions of what a committed culture of innovation is and what a university's mission is. For example, when faculty members want to start a company, frequently they take a leave of absence from the university. On the one hand, it's for release time, but then on the other hand, it's mostly a mission conflict between the university. So ingenuity, innovation, and commercialization depend on creating the right culture in an organization that is embraced by everyone in it. The culture, I believe, actually, is more important than having the right physical and human assets, for they will come if the culture is right. Culture in an organization is characterized by a set of characteristics: attitudes, values, goals, and practices. Attitudes, values, goals, and practices. Every organization, everyone of any scale, formal, informal, has a culture to it. And it's based on these attitudes, values, goals, and practices that are shared by all the members of that organization. Now, I have on the slide here, which is something I can't talk about because of the time, I've probably almost already over my time. These are seven characteristics that I have found of cultures of innovation when I've studied various ones around the world, ones that actually work well. They share these seven characteristics, and you could add some others too, but these are the ones. They have, you know, strong leadership, minimal hierarchy and decision-making, committed to deliverables and implementation. They value disparate talents and entrepreneurship, very key issue, disparate talents. They value ideas, creativity, unconventional. They move quickly but adapt readily, and they are willing to accept failures. And you can think of examples right off of these, like Apple, DARPA, Google, Lockheed Martin, Skunk Works. They all have this characteristic. In fact, Skunk Works, for example, was created so it could create such a culture. That's why the Skunk Works was set aside. To some extent, that's why RPE was set aside from the Department of Energy, so you could create the right culture. We need to understand that culture is a big issue here if you want to really create ingenuity and innovative environment. Now, the universities can satisfy some of these ingenuity, culture, innovation needs, but not all of them, because they have different a mission that actually separates. So some of the points the universities could do. During instruction, they could ensure that they introduce students to implementation and hands-on product focus, along with a basic subject matter, to complete the arc from ingenuity to product. That arc. The students really benefit from having a complete experience. Secondly, participation of engineering in competitions and challenges and prizes and entrepreneurial initiatives can move students closer to this arc from concept to product and measurable outcomes. This is a culture need. Examples of that, of course, are even things like Engineers Without Borders, but Solar Decathlon, and all of these major competitions that are so important. Third, every student, every university student in all fields should be introduced to innovation and entrepreneurship. Not just engineers, the artists, the historians, all fields. It's an essential idea because disparate talents are key to innovation cultures. Everyone can benefit from exposure to this exposure, and you never know who is going to be that player that has this imaginative idea for the big one. They usually come in different ways. And then finally, they need to help every student understand what an innovative culture is. So they learn why it works, why it's necessary, and what it means to be part of it, even if it's a little tough. Now, universities also have to think about the ingenuity tools need here. And we've alluded to it already. The greatest, in my view, what I can see at the moment, the greatest unmet tools need derives from this accelerating advances of engineering creations. As the lifetime of products and creations shortens, so does the value of engineering capabilities that went into them. The in-demand talent kind of need for the now retains high value and will continue to do so. But who is responsible for aiding the re-education of the former in-demand workforce for the next in-demand need? No one has stepped up to this yet, even though the numbers displaced are large and can only get larger fast with increasingly accelerating change, which we should all expect. Industry has not stepped up. Universities have not stepped up. Government has not stepped up. These people are just left hanging out there. An attractive working environment requires a multi-sector solution to this problem. This is a big policy problem. There will not be really an engineering workforce needed if this problem is not corrected, and soon, because no one's going to go into engineering. No one's going to go into engineering for a three-year job. So finally, I think that's a big policy issue. Finally, and most importantly, we need to understand that rekindling ingenuity is more of a culture problem than a tools problem. It is more about changing the context for engineering innovation that is giving tools for it. However, the attractiveness of the environment is also critical to inspiring a committed workforce. Re-education could also be considered part of this culture problem as well. So it's like any system. I mean, understanding how the system works leads to building it and modifying it and using it more effectively. Thank you very much.
Well, good morning, everybody. It's a pleasure to be here with you this morning and share with you some thoughts from my perspective at the National Science Foundation. Actually, I should be more accurate, National Science Foundation Engineering Directorate perspective on topic at hand. And I'm glad to be joined in very distinguished company and hope that my remarks will complement what others are going to say. So let me just begin with just a couple of slides on NSF engineering to give you some background and then address some of the issues that were mentioned. So we regard our mission is to enable the engineering and scientific communities to advance the frontiers of engineering research, innovation, and education in partnership with engineering community and in service to society and nation. So that's our mission statement, that's what we want to do. And as a vision for the engineering directorate, what we want to do is to be the global leader in identifying and catalyzing, those are the keywords, identifying and catalyzing fundamental engineering research, innovation, and education. So this is what we would like to accomplish and achieve. How we are organized is sort of important to understand how we think about the issues at hand. So if you look at the bottom part of this chart, those are the five divisions in the engineering directorate. The three in the center represent the traditional engineering departments that you would find on any major engineering college in the country. So we have CBET, which is chemical, bioengineering, environmental and transport systems. Transport is sort of fluid mechanics, thermal sciences, and so forth. Then we have civil, mechanical, manufacturing innovation. So that's sort of civil engineering, mechanical engineering, manufacturing, those types of activities. Materials, to a great extent, falls under CMMI. And then we have ECCS, the electrical communication, cyber systems, is under ECCS. Then at the two ends are two cross-cutting divisions. So let me talk about EEC, which is Engineering Education and Centers. So that's the division that houses all our ERC, Engineering Research Center program, as well as all our education investments, engineering education research, broadening participation, and those types of programs are in EEC. And then on the right-hand side is IIP, which is Industrial Innovation and Partnerships. As you know, each federal agency has to spend a certain fraction of its budget on SBIR, STTR. For NSF, all of its SBIR, STTR is housed in engineering under IIP. So no other division, say math, physical sciences, or even computer, CISC directorate, does SBIR. We do all of SBIR for NSF under IIP. But it also has our programs on innovation, such as I-Core, partnerships for PFI, partnership for innovation. All of that is housed under IIP. And then we have some cross-cutting programs. Nanotechnology, which has been a major investment for the nation. Mike Rocco is a senior advisor in that area. We have EFRI, which looks at frontier research directions, not in any specific sub-part of the organization, and so he leads that. And so that sort of is the picture. As was mentioned, we have about $800 million-plus budget, all of which goes out to the community. Nothing stays inside the building. For NSF as a whole, we spend 6% on operation, 94% of our money actually goes to the community. It's one of the most efficient, I think, one of the most efficient research organizations in the country. Just show the budget trajectory. I think it's gone pretty well in terms of having consistent support between various administrations in terms of supporting engineering research. There is a big blip in 2009 because of Stimulus Act, so there was a big investment of money, but if you take that out, the trend line is still going up. Certainly, one might ask, is this enough? And of course, the answer is, our acceptance rate is 16%. So one out of six proposals makes it through our process, so five out of six don't. And there are lots of really good ideas that we are not able to fund because we don't have enough money. But nevertheless, it still is a substantial budget to support engineering research and education in the nation. So, issues at hand. So when I thought about the topic of today's panel, I said, how would I imagine engineering 2.0? And the first thing I would say is pretty much what Dan did in his commentary, which is to articulate a really vital and essential role for engineering to enable a prosperous, exciting, secure, healthy, and sustainable future for the United States and for the world. I think that's number one. Without that, there is really no engineering 2.0, and I think Dan did a fantastic job of talking about why engineering is so important for this. Drilling down, I think it would be really fabulous to have ambitious, specific, but achievable grand challenges. So National Academy did a great job of articulating grand challenges. What I would argue now as we look at Engineering 2.0 is to make those grand challenges more specific, more ambitious, specific, but concrete and achievable. So, you know, a great example of grand challenge is often the President Kennedy statement of landing a man on moon. Something that concrete that you know whether you got it or not. I think it excites the imagination. So I would argue that that should be a piece of Engineering 2.0. Third, mutually reinforcing roles for fundamental translation and applied research. So as you know, engineering research connects, as Dan said, what's here to the real world. So it's a combination of fundamental work, but which sees practice. And it is really a feedback loop. So seamless transitions between research, innovations, practical realizations, and none of this is sort of a linear process. This is the big mistake people make when they think about research and its commercialization. Is that these are feedback loops. You're learning all the time as you take these various steps. And I think we need to articulate those feedback loops and transitions, make the barriers smaller. And finally, none of this is going to be possible if we don't address the education challenges. So engineering education innovations to overcome what I think are really stubborn and arguably intractable long-standing problems in retention, diversity, K through 12, so on and so forth. We have been at it for at least as long as I've been a professor. We've been talking about this. We need more innovations in this space to really change the game. How are we going to do this? We've got to be mindful of the larger context. First of all, I would say engineering appeals because of its role in things such as economic growth, competitiveness, employment, and sustainability. And this is a very complicated topic. In fact, the book that's on this table, I'm sure, addresses bits and pieces of this, but it really is far more complicated than, I'm not an economist, I don't understand everything that goes on here, but that's one of the major ways that we need to position engineering in this larger context. Energy system, I think this is a huge game-changing development that's going on in front of our eyes, natural gas, renewables. Third thing, which I think is going to get more and more prominence, which already has, is the whole area of infrastructure. Interacting infrastructure systems, whether that's electricity, water, gas, transport, and telecommunications, and so on and so forth. These are all networks that are talking to each other and interacting with each other, smart, resilient infrastructure. Changing paradigms in manufacturing. We take great pride in saying that engineering directorate played a role in what has now become additive manufacturing and 3D printing. We funded the basic work in solid modeling back before we knew this was going to become an important thing. Next point would be the service sector. As we know, US economy is 85% services. And engineering needs to find its place in transforming quality productivity performance, whether that's education, that's healthcare, no matter where you look, we have a big role to play in the service sector in terms of improving those metrics. And finally, we've got to think about all this in a global context. Global flows of components, products, services, knowledge, and people. And so any imagining of engineering 2.0 must be cognizant of the real dynamic, fluid world that in which we live. So what's our strategy at NSF? And that's my closing comments. Number one, we want to attract the engineering research community. We want to stimulate them. We want to catalyze, and we want to challenge. We really want to challenge the community to think big, to enable transformational advances and expand national innovation capacity. So when you look at our sort of, you know, org chart, we are very focused on taking all our research and coupling it to the innovation ecosystem of the country. And things such as I-4 and PFI are pieces of this puzzle. We strive for portfolio balance. We don't want to overdo in any direction, so we are responsible for fundamental research funding in the country, but we are also interested in coupling back to more translation and applied work. We also want to do balance between small, medium, and large. So ERC is our large investment, smaller individual investigator grants, medium would be something like EFRI type of project. So we are constantly thinking about balance between these different pieces. New approaches to address engineering education challenges. We are very open to new ideas in that space and very willing to experiment. We've got lots of things that we are thinking about in that area. And finally, I think this is really what we are striving to do, is to collaborate and partner. Engineering Directorate is piece of a larger puzzle, and so we collaborate inside NSF and outside NSF. So within NSF, we collaborate with Computer Science Directorate, with Math and Physical Sciences, with Bio Directorate. Almost every directorate, we have strong partnerships in areas of mutual benefit. But outside of NSF, Department of Energy, Department of Defense, NIST, Department of Commerce, Department of Agriculture. We had a wonderful meeting just a few weeks ago with Department of Agriculture on where engineering could collaborate with agriculture to make a big difference on some huge problems that are coming up in the food area. But beyond federal government, we are collaborating with private sector, the Intel GE NSF partnership on 10K engineering project. All our I-Corps, SBIR, STTR, PFI are partnerships with private industry. So basically partner with like-minded people with complementary interests to address national priorities. So with that, I'm going to stop, and thank you very much.
Thank you. Very interesting. That's good.
Robert, first of all, thank you very much for the invitation. Excited. Very excited to be here with this panel, and Dan Promot, very, very exciting comments. At the beginning, Robert, you talked about the kind of change we are discussing today. The challenge with changes, you have to know in which direction you want to change. And I don't know if somebody in the room remembers Niels Bohr. He's a physics Nobel laureate, and besides being strong in physics, he was actually somebody who thought a lot about change, and he thought about predictions. And he found this incredible, intelligent sentence which says, predictions are very difficult, especially when they refer to the future. And I couldn't agree more. And that's exactly the challenge we're all in when we want to change. What do you want to change to? And so what we did is we looked at some megatrends that we believe are relevant for the change we are going through. And we looked at megatrends like climate change, urbanization, demographic change, and globalization. Just to give you there some numbers, 2012 was the year in 350,000 years where the CO2 concentration was the highest in this whole term, 350,000 years. So there's something happening, obviously. Urbanization, 2009, first time more people lived in cities than in urban areas, than in non-urban areas. When you look at mega cities, 75 we had 3 worldwide. 2025 we will have 25 worldwide. When you think about the demographic change, in 2050, the average age is going to be 76 years, and this is global. This includes every country in the world. Just to give you a feeling, in the 50s, we were at average, max is the life expectancy, not average age, the life expectancy. We were around in the low 40s. What a difference. In this time, when we look at 2050, we will double the number of people that are 65 years or older compared to today. And last but not least, globalization. In 69, we had 10,000 multinationals. In 2008, we had 82 multinationals. So this is a little bit the picture from Dan. This is the science out there that we bring into our minds. So very interesting data. Question is, what do we do with these data? And the next step is really to draw something which we call a picture of the future. We drew a picture of the future for each of our businesses. And when you look at these megatrends, and then you draw a picture of the future for our energy business, then you look into the energy business, and you're a producer of gas turbines, but not of, for example, wind energy, then you know there's something wrong in your portfolio. We acquired at the time a small company in Denmark, a 300 million company at the time, for wind energy. It's today a two-digit billion euro business inside Siemens for wind energy. So there's a major change that's happening. When you look at these trends, you think about what do they influence on your individual business. When we now come closer to our topic today, to industry, to engineering, what we identified is the next step where industrial companies, especially in developed countries, where they make the next step of efficiency, of productivity, is integrating the engineering, the design world of products with the manufacturing world. And next week there will be a study published from the MIT Production in the Innovation Economy. And they exactly talk there about this requirement, design, and manufacturing, the close connection. It can be physically together, or it can be virtually integrated. But this integration really will make a difference, and I will talk about this. So when we tried then to develop it once further, we said there are three major drivers. One is which we call increased efficiency. Some could say old to new. Manufacturing plants of today, when you walk through them, if you go into the most modern automotive factories in Detroit, or you go to Volkswagen in Chattanooga, the floor, it's a lab. It's so clean. You can physically eat from the floor. This is how factories, real modern factories, look today. Reduce time to market. It's really the integration of virtual and real. And last but not least, enhanced flexibility. A lot of hype and discussion about 3D printing, but there are many other elements to this. Let me go into those three. First, efficiency and productivity. If you compare a traditional setup in a factory, and you compare this to modern drive motor system, and just to give you a feeling, 70% of electrical energy used in plants is used for something that's moving. And behind this movement, usually, is an electric motor somewhere. And the opportunity is there when you look at a very traditional setup to a modern setup, you can do the same output with 70% less energy input, which is a major step change. It's not a small step change. So that's just one example, similar examples on productivity. Next one is, as I mentioned before, virtual to real. Virtual to real, what really does this mean? It means there's somebody sitting in Detroit, he makes a change to design, and he knows what this means in his manufacturing facility in Rüsselsheim or in his manufacturing facility in Shanghai. Why is this so important? Because if he doesn't, he might make this wonderful design change, chooses between three alternatives, and then he's surprised that the time to market is 6 months longer because in Rüsselsheim the equipment is not set up to produce this. If he would have made change A instead of B, he could have gone to market right away. Now, this is one view of it. The other view is some things are just not possible without a virtual realization. If you think of the Mars rover. The Mars rover, as it was sent up a year ago, is the heaviest equipment that was ever sent up to Mars. If you think about it, it's a Mini Cooper. It's a Mini Cooper in size, a Mini Cooper in weight. And so it was very difficult to bring it safe down on the ground on Mars. And what they did is they tried to lift the landing was a key element. Now, how many prototypes can you build? How many physical tests can you do landing on the Mars? Pretty much zero. You can't do it. So the only way is to test it virtually. And through all these virtual tests, they came up with a very complex system, and many of you have seen it. It's a parachute. It's decelerating rockets. And then at the end, it comes a sky crane. And it's just fascinating how it was done. And if you had the opportunity to see this, it's the faces of the people involved that worked for 10 years in this project, and then seeing this landing safely. And why were they confident that it happens? Because they tried it 1,000 times. They tried it 1,000 times virtually on the PC. So this is about integration of virtual and real. And last but not least, we talk about flexibility. When you think of flexibility increase, some people also talk about lot size one, mass customization. Producing individualized products at a price point where you usually only produce mass products. Now, there are different ways of handling it. You know, one company that 100 years ago produced a car, and you had an incredible selection between exactly one color. The same company today can produce an F-150 in billions of different variants. You can't choose on billions, you can only choose millions. You can still choose millions. And how is it done? With a very complex software system behind it. So that's the easy possibilities that exist in assembly structures. But they're also in additive manufacturing. We talk about the Additive Manufacturing Institute in Youngstown. We are highly involved there. Actually, we are involved through the Youngstown State University. We think this is a very element, a very important element of the future. We gave a grant of $440 million in software to Youngstown State University, participating in 3D printing. But it's actually a little bit hype. The reality is that many of these individualized production can done today, and I give you this example here of subtractive manufacturing. You can do many things like this already today. And many of, when you think of the aging population, many of us at some point in time might need a new knee or a new hip, and then hopefully this is good use to your fitting and not to somebody else's. And what you want to do is then to have the integration of the engineering chain. Where does this all lead to? We believe there's a future coming up which really talks about cyber-physical systems. What does it mean? It means a complete integration of virtual and real. And if you would like to get a feel for this and see this, on the 5th of September, so last week, there was a video going viral from Elon Musk. He talks about the future of design, 3.5 minutes. If you see, it's on YouTube, and if you follow my tweet, my tweet is Helmut Ludwig, just a name. I have this on there. It's really fascinating. Link to this short video. But what's also important and key is all these cyber physical and everything. It's not the light out factory. And oops, let me make very clear. It's all about people. This will not happen just by chance. To get what's in here back out again, you need the engineers that make it happen. You need the people on the shop floor that have the knowledge to work with highly engineered products and highly engineered equipment. When we doubled more or less the size of our manufacturing facility in Charlotte, we were looking for the right people to put on the factory floor. And there, today, very little to do with the manufacturing of our grandfathers. It's a completely different manufacturing. And we started there an education program very much following the German model of dual education. They go through a three and a half year program in mechatronics. Through these 3.5 years, they are paid. After that, they come out, they get a job with $50,000 a year pay. If you compare this to somebody going to liberal arts college, most of our liberal arts majors, we hire at $42,000, and they have a little bit of debt, some of them at least, in their pocket. Very different view. And this is what you do when young people, intelligent young people, go in manufacturing. So my word here is really, let's find the right people for manufacturing engineering. It's a fascinating world out there. Thank you.
Very interesting. So, Helen, that's good.
Well, first of all, Rob, thank you very much for organizing this panel. And thank you for inviting me to share my thoughts with these distinguished people who are a lot smarter and wiser than I am. There's a lot of things that need to be said already been said. But I'll say it anyway, a few things here. Do I click on you going to do that?
We're pulling up.
All right. All right. So we'll go to the next slide. So we all know this is not rocket science, but the public perception is they think it's rocket science. And while the perception is not reality, but a lot of times the consequences of perception can be real. And that's what I want to talk a little bit about, how single button, click the next slide. Okay. So I'll tell you next slide what. So the point I want to make is that the distinction between science and engineering, as you know, science is about discovery, and as Dr. Dan Mudd pointed out, and engineering is about the creative activity and synthesis. While it's not so much how much we invest, actually, also it's about where do we invest our resources, and the federal investments in primarily in scientific discoveries. If we ignore the engineering aspect, which relates to inventions and innovation, which is actually transforming a promising idea into a marketable product, if we don't do that, we'll see the gap between our investments and the outputs. So we have manufacturing deficits, and also it's not directly helping your economy or national security. That's because we have a fundamental innovation gap. Or being best in the world is still, being best in the world in science is still very critical. But that's not enough. I think what comes after that is very important to create national security and economic security. So here is a chart you see on the left-hand side. It's actually taken from the White House report. The impact of basic research on innovation. Essentially, it talks about how, you know, giving this MP3 player, showing that, that all the componentry, in whether it's the LCD display, lithium-ion battery, all the stuff, the fundamental knowledge that was created for behind all these devices was actually funded by federal government through NSF and DARPA and Department of Energy and what have you, and that is absolutely true. We did create the knowledge, but I don't think we did the innovation in terms of bringing it to the into converting the idea into product and into marketable product. A lot of the innovation in manufacturing happened elsewhere, and that has eroded our supply chains, and that's because, again, the gap we have, innovation gap, which relates to the gaps in engineering. So, but to generally talk about science, the generalization of science to include engineering, again, like I said, has had some real consequences. It's not about the terminology, whether it's called science or engineering, but it has real consequences, both in our investments as well as in outcomes. So if you look at the investments in the government investments in R&D, as you know, between 2001 and 2011, in most fields, in all the STEM fields, you know, it's about 8.1% increase. And of course, in the life sciences field, as we know, it's about 7% increase in investments there. Math and computer science, 4.3% increase, which is all very good. This is fantastic. But of course, there's a lot written about how the physical sciences, the investments was actually 0%. The point is, there is actually a minus 4.3%. There's a decline in engineering funding, when, and the worst part is not many people are talking about it. And so it does make a difference when you combine and include engineering and science. If you look at the investments in our engineering education, and just to make this complicated chart simple, if you look at just NSF alone, $1.4 billion investments in STEM education, and of which a little over 1% is in engineering education. So this is where we are not investing in the way the engineering education deserves, because everything is combined under STEM. And if you look at some of the research outcomes, which is also the, going back to the earlier chart between science and manufacturing, the innovation gap, here is just one example of nanotechnology. The chart shows how the ranking of various nations on nanotechnology, the bubbles in the chart represent different countries. If you look at the top half, the top of the chart, the nanotechnology activity, if you look at the United States, the usual suspects, they're doing very well in the amount of activity, US, Germany, Japan, South Korea, and Taiwan. But if you look at the horizontal axis about the technology development strength, and as you can see, as the report concluded, Japan, South Korea, and Germany will be much more successful growing their economies with nanotech because the technology development strength there on the right-hand side quadrant. The U.S. is, according to the report, is in the ivory tower category. So the other way to look at that, I said the different viewpoints, is in one of the congressional testimonies by a senior government official, I'll read it. It says, a recent analysis of the number of nanotechnology citations, patents, and publications show that we are very quickly being surpassed by other nations in an area where, until recently, we had strong leadership, strong lead. This has the potential of putting our national security at risk, since technological superiority has been a foundation of our national security since World War II. The point I want to make here is that, again, goes between science and engineering. The equating technologies, technological superiority to the number of publications and citations I have issue with. I think when President Roosevelt talked about arsenals of democracy, I don't think he was talking about publications and citations. And so I think we got to take the ideas beyond, going beyond publications, especially in the engineering realm. In terms of research output from the scientific point of view, it does make sense because it's a fundamental discovery of knowledge, new body of knowledge that needs to be disseminated, and publish or perish, as academics call it. It makes perfect sense, and it might make very good sense in the case of scientific disciplines. But in engineering, you got to do beyond just publications. And this is why, even if you're publishing in engineering, for example, there are no prestigious journals like Science and Nature. So the real successful engineers actually publish in Science and Nature because those are quite prestigious. And doing engineering science and publications, which I believe are only intermediate outputs to real output being engineering. But on the other hand, universities are ranked based on inputs, not outcomes. That's a different story. So, and in terms of the STEM, first of all, STEM really means science and math, and E is silent, and T is essentially information technology. And if you look at it, K through 12, why aren't, it's not that we want more engineers, we can debate that, but it's like we are scaring away a lot of smart kids in middle schools and elementary schools from going into engineering because we put artificial barriers. For one thing, we don't teach engineering in K through 12. And so we have only 4% of the kids wanting to go into engineering, compared to 10% in Canada, 15% in Germany, and 25% in China. And when we go to engineering schools, a lot of the focus is more on the analytics rather than the creative aspects of engineering. Also, a lot of that has been changing lately, but I want to point out most of that is still on the engineering science part of it. And those who are graduating from engineering schools, about 50% of them end up going for non-engineering, taking non-engineering professions. It can be good or bad because engineering does provide a broad foundation. So the other problem is, when we talk about any of this, a lot of times the discussion goes about, we don't have enough women and minorities going into engineering. I think that is true. We want more women and minorities going into engineering, but that is not the crux of the problem. We don't have a lot of other people going into engineering. So the problem, that's because of the image problem. And also, I say gender gap is not the issue, because although we have about 20% enrollment in bachelor's level and PhD level, women enrollment in engineering, but if you look at environmental engineering and biomedical engineering, the two areas where women think they could actually make a difference in the world, because it appeals to them because it can make a difference. And there, the enrollments and the graduation rates are close to 50%. So we need to make that connection between what engineers do, what engineering is about. So there are a lot of excellent examples, very good practices, but you need to scale those best practices. There are a number of examples, I put a few here, there are companies like Still and Siemens and other companies doing some great work in terms of promoting engineering. The summer engineering camps, you can read, this is a typical unsolicited comment from a parent, how I experienced this 5-day summer camp that, their son wants to become an engineer. And because they see value in doing things because they were exposed to the creative activity, which try to beat out of in our schools. And the FIRST Robotics and Project Lead the Way, these are all very good examples. And the National Academy of Engineering started making efforts to change this conversation about promoting the image of engineering, which is great. And I also want to give an example of Olin College that some of you may know. And their fundamental mission is to produce engineering innovators. And it should not surprise anyone, 50% of the Olin graduates are women. And so we have a lot of challenges at every level in terms of promoting engineering and doing it well for national security and for our economic security. Because science creates knowledge. Its application of knowledge is what creates, wealth. So an early education, while as much as I love FIRST Robotics, it's great. But we need to do that in the mainstream, not as an extracurricular activity, because they're drawing kids who are already motivated. Which is great, but we need to bring it into mainstream. In high schools, again, the industry has a role to play and a responsibility in terms of going back to internships and apprenticeships, which most companies have abandoned. And they can do a lot of good in terms of promoting this. And at the university level, or even across, we need to really rebrand engineering as a creative discipline, which Dr. Mott already talked about. That is important. And because that's what it is. When we talk about research and development, it's time to put AND back in R&D. Not just, as Pramod already mentioned, NSF is doing in terms of not just the basic research, but translational research and applied research, because that's what engineering is about. So, and the NSF ICORE program is a good, important first step. And also in public policy, again, it goes back to the perception about science and engineering, and investing in STEM doesn't mean you're investing in engineering. So, and then there's no single voice. We have 32 different engineering societies. Whereas when it comes to sciences, they do a great job. You know, AAAS is the one single society that actually, you know, people pay attention to. So we need to establish a single and a unified voice for engineering that's lacking in public policy circles. And we certainly want to create a national, we should create a national campaign to inspire any minds about rocket engineering. So, thank you.
So I want to open it up for comments in just a minute, but first of all, I thought those comments were great from all four of our speakers. And let me try to attempt to summarize what I heard in hopefully some kind of conceptual framework. It seems to me that at the very top level, what we're talking about here today is we need to devote more of our national resources to engineering. Now, I know that we're walking into a very dangerous slope here because we're given budget problems, now we're into reallocations, and people start getting defensive and all. I understand that. But having said that, I do think it's important that we ramp up engineering as an overall national focus. That's just not just about budgets, but about focus. Really, I thought Sridhar's comment about STEM is right. We don't really have STEM. We have SM. That's what we have. We have SM. We have SM. We don't teach engineering in high schools. You know, there's now a new DARPA project that's got, I think, 10 high schools with maker programs in them. That's fantastic. But we don't really. Engineering is an afterthought. We should be teaching engineering in every single high school in America. Secondly, within engineering, I think one of the things I heard today is there needs to be more of a focus on big grand challenges. And I would say one of the big grand challenges is competitiveness and productivity. You know, if we don't get those right, we're not going to be able to thrive as a country. And not a criticism of ERCs, Pramod, but only one ERC is a manufacturing-focused ERC. Now, I know that's partly because of the way the applications come in, but I think one of the challenges is we've got to really get engineering to be solving big problems around how we're going to be able to be an effective competitor in the global economy. And the third really goes down to about changing the culture, which is a lot of what Dan's comments were about, a culture of engineering education that really stresses experiential learning and implementation, that stresses entrepreneurship and creative discipline. Sridhar talked about Olin College. If you haven't looked at Olin, you should. A small school. I'm not saying it's the model for everything, but 10% of Olin graduates, who, by the way, have a BS degree, 10% of them have started a company. Yeah, that's phenomenal. That is phenomenal. They're doing something right there about integrating engineering with design and with business. And then also we talked a little bit about a portfolio balance. Both Pramod and Sridhar talked about that. It can't just be basic research. It's got to be a more balanced portfolio, be translational, applied, and basic. So that, to me, seems as if that's our challenge. Now, I'll close with something that I've already gotten in trouble with, but we just propose, and maybe we're being a little bit provocative, but why don't we think about changing the name of NSF to the National Science and Engineering Foundation? And let's symbolically, let's say, look, it's not just science. It's science and engineering. It's as Dan said, it's this and it's that. I was struck by the fact that the Smithsonian used to have the word technology in their title, and they took it out. They took it out after there was this anti-technology movement back in the 70s. I think we've got to rethink sort of these symbolic things and elevate engineering and technology back to where it used to be. So with that, why don't we open it up for any comments or questions? If you want to just raise your hand and identify yourself, and then if it's to a particular person, yes, ma'am, right here.
From the Scientific Technology Policy Institute. Rob, you mentioned that with several other panelists, the concept of grand challenges. A few years ago, the National Academy of Engineering had come out with a few grand challenges, and you know, you can struggle with one or two of them, but on the whole, they were pretty spectacular. Why did that fizzle, and is there any effort to bring that back into the mainstream?
Maybe I should talk about it, since I sort of represent the Academy in a way. In a way, it's an understatement, I guess. Let's see, how does this go? Oh, great. Well, I think fizzle is not exactly the word I would use for the grand challenges. I in fact, think they are on fire, as a matter of fact, not fizzling. In fact, the grand challenges, there's 14 of them. They pretty much span everything you want to think about, by the way. In fact, that essentially was one of the criticisms someone brought up, said maybe it was you who brought up Pramod, that Pramod said we need grand challenges that are very specific, you know, get to the moon. They are not that specific. They essentially cover domains, you know, engineer the brain, things like that. Make solar energy economical. So they cover rather big spans. They have, in fact, been one of the most successful and most attractive and most expanding activities in the history of the National Academy of Engineering. They have brought people to them like a magnet. For example, the three deans of Duke, USC, and Olin, have taken on the grand challenges and promulgated them to other universities. About 30 universities now have grand challenges programs. There's grand challenges scholars programs. They've taken on initiatives. People get degrees in grand challenges topics on very specialized areas. So it in fact has pushed the National Academy out nationally, and even pushed the National Academy out internationally. In March of this year, where was for the first time, three national academies created the Global Grand Challenges Symposium in London in March. That's the Royal Academy of Engineering, the Chinese Academy of Engineering, and the U.S. National Academy had this Global Grand Challenges Symposium, and they were overwhelmed with people who wanted to come, especially from the United States, by the way. The United States could have filled the entire place up, had 400 seats, we could have filled the entire 400 seats. For people who wanted to come, had to get turned away from it, paying their own way, by the way, not funded by their companies or government, or certainly not us. The Chinese are going to have the next Grand Challenge Symposium in 2 years. The third one, Global Grand Challenge, will be in the United States, the U.S. National Academy. So I would say just the opposite is true, actually. These Grand Challenges have got legs. They're both expanding the reach of the Academy globally, and they're bringing people to the Academy nationally and globally as well. So I think it's one of those topics that, as I think you have expressed in a way, is very attractive. People come to it, and they want it to be successful. So in my view, I'm pushing the grand challenges as hard as I can. But it doesn't do exactly what Pramod said. I mean, it's not going down and say, okay, let's cure dentistry or something. We're going to have no more fillings or something like that. And it doesn't hit a specific topic, but people should hit those specific topics. In other words, it's a kind of umbrella that is going to attract people to it, and then inside of it, there will be the specifics.
Great.
So that's what I would say. Not quite fizzled.
Why don't we can I just
make a very
short so that we get more fixed.
I totally agree with what Dan said, and what I would argue is we need to build on what the Academy did, which is create the excitement about these grand challenges. And the example that I have in mind is take the PV, solar photovoltaic area. I think when Steve Chu, Secretary Chu, put this target of $1 per watt, that made the solar energy economical very, very concrete. So here's the target that we can measure our progress and say, are we going to get there by whatever date you want to put on it? So I'm arguing that let's build on this tremendous excitement and turn these into very concrete goals that we can measure our progress and say we are heading there.
Great. I'm going to go in order. I saw them, so right here, and then John. Ma'am.
I'm working with the American Society for Engineering Education, trying to bring together business and universities to create some pilot projects around Engineering 2.0. And you know, there's a real difficulty I wanted you to address, which is everybody wants to talk about it, but very few people want to start pilot projects or really try to move something forward. And so I want you to just address a little bit our tendency to keep talking about this issue without really pushing forward some targeted ideas.
Who wants to do that one? Sridhar?
Just, I'm wondering if I mean, of course, there's this funding, and if we can get people to sign on to projects and spread the word and actually get kids excited in high schools and everything, that's great. But this is the kind of thing I think National Science Foundation can do in terms of promoting exactly, because ASCEE, engineering education, is one society that's not this, that's a cuts across all engineering disciplines and doing great work. So I think that's where, those are the kinds of things that NSF can do. Good.
Maybe let me give a perspective from an industrial company. We have a lot of collaborations with universities around the world, especially in the US. Just to give you an impression, we work with, on our PM software, we work with 10,000 institutions worldwide. 1.1 million students are every year trained by those institutions with software, which we give as a grant to the universities. I mentioned before Youngstown State University, very close collaboration, University of Michigan, close collaboration. We start, I have to admit, we realized afterwards that we start probably a little late. Late means university is probably already too late if you think about really motivating students for not only science and math, but really for engineering. And we have several pilots running, one in Georgia currently, where team members from our office, we have about 3,000 people employed in Atlanta area, and they go into, not all of them, but some selected young people, usually they're 5 to 6 years with the company, they go in middle schools, and they go in the first 2 years of high school and talk about their job as an engineer. To talk exactly what we saw here, I thought there were some great examples before that you showed on your slides. Now, how do you make engineering, again, attractive? And I really liked your ideas that you showed there. We dissect animals, but we don't dissect the machine tool or something like that. Exciting. And that's, engineering is very exciting. We have to bring it close to the students early on.
John?
A 22-year-old gets out of school with an engineering degree and has 40, 50 years maybe in the labor market ahead of him or her. All kinds of opportunities for learning. Continuous innovation obviously depends on continuous learning. But if we look at the infrastructure for supporting the people who actually do the engineering, to put it in engineering terms, that environment is very, very noisy and almost totally unstructured. You know, a lot of engineers get master's degrees. There's all kinds of stuff on the web now. There's course materials. A few companies like Siemens still have something that looks like an internal labor market. But the people who are out there doing the work have very little organized support for learning and innovating, particularly with the demise of employer-supported training. Isn't that part of the problem? Shouldn't it be on these lists?
I think Dan alluded to that, but who wants to jump into there?
Well, I agree. That was, I think, my maybe the most important point I tried to make, actually, was that this is the big elephant in the room. That is, no one is looking at this question. No one's taking a company, so Siemens obviously sounds like it's doing a good job, and there are isolated cases where there's focus. But this problem has been exacerbated substantially by an order of magnitude or more because of the acceleration of change and the short period in which particular knowledge is of value, economic value. And therefore, there isn't the time to kind of, you know, figure it out on the, in the dirt as it used to be done. It just, things are happening too fast. And our country hasn't come together on how this is going to be handled. No one has taken responsibility for this. It's just kind of dumped on the individuals, by and large. And I think this is a huge problem for our country. You're talking about policy change. And, you know, the industry's got to be at the table on this. Universities have to be there. I mean, universities do not consider this to be their major responsibility, as you know well. It's an auxiliary. Maybe you get paid on the side, you know, if you're given a few hours once a week to teach some course and retraining and so on. It's well beyond that stage now. I think we've got millions of people here that are affected by this. And I think if we want the engineering profession to be attractive, that people have to be able to see that there's a pathway for them to continue to work 40, 50 years as you described. And I don't think that's quite so clear to everybody, especially in the more rapidly moving domains.
Just a quick comment on that. In terms of infrastructure for training and retraining,
First of all, universities provide education. That's different from training. And in terms of the government investments, you know, that we have, you know, National Treasury Office, national labs, you know, federal labs, could do some of that. I know NASA Glenn in Cleveland, working with the community in Cleveland and doing some great things, and there are good examples like that. But fundamentally, the training and retraining falls on the shoulders of industry. You know, they used to do apprenticeships programs and all that. They abandoned that. And they want to have students coming out of college ready to run the latest version of software that somebody's putting out. But that's not what, that's, you know, I think industry has a lot of responsibility in terms of beyond just complaining about not having skilled workers.
But, let me get coming. I don't want to blame, I would, sorry about this, Sridhar. I don't want to blame anybody on this. I think it's a bigger problem than just saying, okay, you guys are faulting. I think this is a national issue. I think there should be a national symposium on this topic. I think the players from industry and universities and government should be at the table. And it really ought to be a big compact on how this is going to be taken on, where everybody's going to have skin in the game and responsibility to it, because it's gone well. It's got to a certain scale that's rather serious, in my view.
Thelma, do you want to share that story or anecdote you shared with me? I don't know if you remember. I'll always remember it. Share it with other people about the difference in U.S. and Germany, where in the U.S. it's about the United Way, and in Germany it's about apprenticeship. You remember saying that? If not, I can explain what you said.
Yeah, why don't you explain what I said?
I think we were both drunk at the time at a cocktail reception. But the point was, and this goes to John's point, there's a sort of tipping point collective action issue here. And in Germany, everybody's in the system. And if you go out of the system, if you pull out and say, I'm going to be a user and not a maker, to use some terms, I'm going to essentially not put in and support the apprenticeship programs or the engineering co-op programs. I'm just going to use what everybody else does. You're sort of shunned in Germany. You're sort of seen as a pariah company. Now, maybe that's a little too strong, but whereas in the U.S. there's no real culture of participation like that. The culture is, well, I give to the United Way and we deal with some poverty issues, but we don't support the collective. And I think the only way to do that, frankly, is there certainly we have some interesting programs, but our proposal has always been we should have a knowledge tax credit. In other words, give the companies tax credits like the R&D credit when they invest in training, whether it's at the engineering level or the workforce. But anyway, I do think it's a systemic problem we have, not just individual companies.
Which let me add to that also helps, because all companies are really involved in these kind of apprenticeship programs. It also helps a certain standardization. So if, for example, in Siemens, we actually, in Germany right now, we do have 10,000 apprentices. Most probably we will afterwards not employ all of them. So there is a certain exchange afterwards. They not all stay in Siemens, they go somewhere else, but they leave with a certificate that has a value, and they know that this has a significant value. So there is an open exchange, and the open exchange, however, is based on this trust that Robert just alluded to, that actually everybody chips in. Everybody is part of the system, defines all the requirements of the future, and is involved. Now, there might be always, there's one or the other free rider, potentially. The challenge is not the one or the two. Every strong system can survive with those. The problem is if these becomes the majority, then the system breaks down. And I don't see currently this. I see a lot of very good pilots in the U.S. actually starting, and it's fascinating. The MIT story, there's a program I mentioned before, they said, a lot of talk, little action. Probably true, but on the other hand, there are many companies that are really taking this very serious, and they're investing into apprenticeship programs. But it's not that year, not there yet, where we have this integrated responsibility that you just mentioned before.
Yes, sir. Right.
I am Satish Kulkarni from Virginia Tech. I have actually two questions. In the future, if engineers are going to go online for education, how do you inculcate a culture of innovation if all I'm doing is learning online? And the second question is that the budget R&D deficit is really not going to change in the future. So if that is the case, you know, how do you rearrange your portfolio given the challenges, you know, which we have discussed today?
You're talking about it.
So,
Yeah, certainly the second question is something that we worry about, you know, on a sort of daily basis in my directorate at NSF. And I think the watchword is balance. That is, we want to make sure that we are funding cutting-edge fundamental research, but also coupling it to translational and then to applied, and creating this very fast feedback loop so that you can see where the gaps in fundamental research are. That, so what I'm trying to do, for example, there is, what do we know in ERCs and IUCRCs? I mean, IUCRCs are just amazing investment for NSF, for engineering. Huge leverage factor, you know, 10 to 1, 8 to 1 leverage factor for NSF. And what I'm, inside NSF, we are talking about is, in these centers, we are becoming aware of what are the real problems, and can we now bring that back into our core discipline-based programs so that we are targeting our investments into solving those problems. So really working on these feedback loops and connecting these different pieces, small, medium, large investments. I mean, I think, you know, you hit it on the head. I mean, we would love to see increased budgets. I mean, and like I said, we can invest that money very wisely for the public. But we still, even in other scenarios, we still want to maximize the value to the public and to the community of the budgets that we have. So, you know, just balancing, maximizing impact of what we are doing.
Let me add to that question a bit. You talked about the innovation issue in online learning versus. Yep. See, the big problem we've had with innovation in our country, and in fact in the world, everybody's been just crazy about innovation. Crazy. It's the answer to every question. Every how will we question, the answer is always innovation. And the reason that everyone has had so much difficulty in actually doing it globally is that there hasn't been a realization that innovation is actually more of a culture than it is a set of rules, and culture is hard to grasp for people. it takes time. That's why I listed the 7 characteristics of cultures of innovation. So to get to your question, if you want the online student or any student for that matter, in fact it's been shown to be a problem anywhere, to have an understanding of innovation, they need to understand what the culture of innovation is that makes it work. Why does it work? And I think, so you would have to, I don't know if this can be done, by the way, but you'd have to online help educate people about what a culture of innovation is. Think of very creative teaching methods and techniques to really go over this and inculcate with them what this culture is like, even though they won't have a chance to experience it themselves. And of course, we know if you don't experience it yourself, you don't actually get it entirely. And that's, so I'm not sure whether you can actually get it entirely. But you could know what it is, at least. And that would be, I think, the first step.
Addressing the future demand for engineering is going to involve exploring institutions, policies like economics and tax, talent issues, and even wondering how to instill a culture of innovation, and to what effect. Measuring its effect. These are issues for the behavioral and social sciences as much as they are
absolutely
issues.
Absolutely. Yeah, I always wondered why the behavior and social sciences have been so asleep on this topic.
Well, there is a tendency among some to rush to the physical and life sciences because they see the innovations coming there as opposed to.
Well, let me tell you what I have been told by social scientists when this question has come up. They say to me, culture is not something we want to deal with because it's not quantitative. And you cannot be science unless you're quantitative. That's why we have... So therefore, they tend not to go there. In fact, I heard it just yesterday on a topic. So it's not an attractive topic, I've been told, for social scientists, because it's moving, from their point of view, away from science, which is where they want to go. How does that resonate with you?
Well, I would disagree. Obviously, when you look at individual discipline and the way people are trained, yes, they're going to have that point of view. You know, I once asked a distinguished cognitive scientist, why doesn't he allow his students to really go after the decision-making roles in policy-making? And he said, look, these kids have got to get out in 2 or 3 years. You know, give them experiments to do and let them publish something, and so we can graduate.
Right.
So there are forces against it, but even so, there are many who go into this field. The funding is just a paucity. It's a tiny program in NSF, and I don't even see it relating to other disciplines of science, let alone engineering.
On a more positive note, I mean, you know, I agree with what Dan said. I mean, I'm really stunned by how hungry the community is for iPort program. I mean, our iPort is just a runaway success. We are building out a network. We are building nodes. We are investing as fast as we possibly can in iCore, and the demand for it is just incredible. We are spreading it to states now. I'm trying to find a way to scale iCore you know, in an exponential fashion, because I think that's... So, to me, that's a very positive sign that the community is hungry for it, and we are going to do everything we can from NSF to expand as fast as we possibly can, and then bring partners to the table, because there are limits to what NSF can do. So I'm very interested in partnering, I'm very interested in scaling, I'm very interested in figuring out who else can take on.
So we have time for one last question, but I just can't resist making a comment here. I don't think the issue here, Myron, is about insight or knowledge. The issue is about will. You know, we know how to create innovative organizations. We know there have been, you know, as we talk about in our book, there's a science of innovation that has occurred over the last 15 years. We know what to do. We just don't do it because it's incredibly hard. And it requires, you know, that's why, you know, there's a thing called creative destruction, because there's a destruction component here. I mean, Olin College has no tenure. Anybody from a college here who supports getting rid of tenure? Anybody from a college supports getting rid of departments? Okay, they have no departments. I'm not from a college. No departments and no tenure. Now, okay, I'm not saying that's the model, but it is a radical innovation, institutional innovation. You know, I look at RIT, for example, Rochester Institute of Technology. The president installed right next to the dorm where they create a special dorm with students, engineering students who want to be entrepreneurial. And then right next to it is a 24/7 lab open every day of the year with 3D printers, CAD machine, CAD design. And the students can go over there and dabble and do things. Now, that's an institutional innovation. And so I think we know what to do. We just are too inertial to make these big changes. I'm sorry, we're going to have time just for one last question. Well, maybe we'll get to two if it's quick. So go ahead.
I'm one of those famous engineering teachers from the high school level, and I also coach a robotics team. And this has been fabulous. I really appreciate this. But I felt a long time that we've got to the STEM crisis, because probably not so much by the way we've always done things despite that, but probably because of teaching science and math the way we do, as discrete skills without application. And, you know, FIRST has all these statistics that say, you know, if a student goes and participates on a robotics team, they have this much percentage chance of becoming an engineer. And I look at that and I go, I think it's more the students that are interested in engineering do FIRST robotics. Because I don't think we capture them early enough in your childhood when they're going through math and science. So I guess I would ask you how you would recommend to us to get our math and science teachers at earlier levels teaching more application.
I think math and science teachers should continue to excel in teaching math and science, which is great. But we could also bring in, you know, I mean, if they want to teach engineering, that's been fantastic. I think one of the things, again, we could do is that get, you know, universities and industry to contribute to projects, for example. I'm thinking a lot right now. There could be a grand challenge from, you know, National Academy of Engineering or National Science Foundation to say, think of these projects that we can, you know, it could be a small prize, but the thing is, you could get everybody thinking about creating high school projects, middle school projects. It's even more important. And that's how we can scale and get people to you know, embrace this. And also, along with the projects, you can also provide some teaching materials, right?
So, I mean, at NSF, we are very interested in the space you are talking about. And, in fact, I was at a conference in Atlanta where we talked about how E in STEM is at the heart of STEM. I mean, E is in the heart of STEM. And we have funded several projects. We are creating that have created the materials that are widely available. What we need to do is to get those materials in the hands of teachers who are interested. And then, in terms of NSF role, we are kind of creating the materials, we are funding projects where these things will happen. I think it's the demand side that needs some work. That is, are school superintendents, are principals, are they incentivizing their teachers to kind of pick this up? I mean, a school teacher is, you know, teaching 5-6 hours a day. What incentives are there for them to pick, you know, this would be extra work. I mean, they could spend some time to learn this stuff. So we need to work more on the demand side so that the school teachers are rewarded and incentivized to do this. But from our point of view, we are actually very interested in pushing on this direction. And I can offline share with you all the materials that are becoming available because of NSF investments.
I have to make two comments on this. I'm sorry, but apologize for being a little bit over here. This is a great question. The first thing I should mention is that we just have in place the next generation science standards. And these science standards are laced with engineering design all over the place. The first time in history, by the way, engineering has ever showed up, the E word has showed up in the science standards. And so this is a big step, and 45 states have adopted, my last count, adopted these science standards. So it's going to be out there. And just a little anecdote. On Independence Day, I was down in the mall with my dog and grandchildren, or they were walking me, and I was standing under a little tree there while they were watching jugglers and so forth. And a young man who was 40-ish and his wife, same age, tourist-like, came up to me and said, "You must be a senator," they said to me. At one time, I'd really been proud of that. Anyway, I said, no, I'm an engineer. I work down the mall. She said, "Oh," he said to me, this man, 40, said, "We are, you mean at the National Academy building?" I said, "Yes." He says, "We are grade school teachers from Tampa, Florida. And I just want to tell you that these new science standards are so important. Our science department is putting them forward so we can teach engineering. Finally, we're gonna bring engineering. It's so important for the future of our country." This is the grammar school teachers told me this. So I think there is hope here that when these get out there and get promulgated, that this it's a bright light to the future.
I have to say, Dan, I'm a little more pessimistic than you are because I think it's really interesting. Whenever we talk about STEM or engineering, we always end up at some point usually talking about K-12. And it's interesting when we talk about college, we talk about innovation, we talk about embedding new kinds of discipline, new kinds of pedagogies, new kinds of learning, entrepreneurship, creativity. And then when we talk about grade school and high school, we talk about standards. So we're not talking about, no one's talked about project-based learning. I mean, there are a few high schools now that have abandoned courses. They're just 100% project-based learning. And yet, you can probably count those on two hands. Why aren't we creating 100 project-based learning high schools? Why are we having a pedagogy that's still around? I mean, I remember my son went to BCC, Bethesda Chevy Chase, and his computer science was 55 minutes a day, 5 days a week, and it was incredibly pedantic and boring. And why aren't we talking about schools where you spend 2 weeks on a great computer science project and really rethink the curriculum? So I'm not saying standards aren't going to play a role, although I have to say I'm much less optimistic on the math standards. I think they're not related to a lot of what people are going to actually do. But I think we need to be thinking about real change in schools, real new models. And it's not just about teachers sort of drilling more what we already do. Sridhar.
Just a quick comment. I think the new science standards at least give a way to bring in engineering into the curriculum, which you never had that before.
Sure.
But now we can take that opportunity and create a lot of exciting project-based learning and innovation curriculum.
Right.
And there are programs like Innovation 101 that Henry Ford has created at different levels, at elementary, middle, and high school levels, for what innovation is, and having, you know, there are a lot of interesting ideas out there. But these standards, at least, is the first.
Mm-hmm.
Sure. I guess I'd just say there's a lot of interesting ideas, and they're sort of still this kind of they're like the equivalent of skunk works, if you will. So we have a few little things over there that are in the corner that are doing really creative things, and then we have the vast mass that's doing the same thing. So I think we should stop. We're actually over 7 minutes over, which we normally never do, but this was such a great discussion. I felt it was worth just going over a little bit of time. A couple things. The slides will be up on our website, as will the video tomorrow. And I want to thank you all for coming, and please thank a great, great panel for their comments and insights.
Good.
See you again. Hopefully, we'll find a way of time for you.
Yeah.
And have a next more extended conversation because
I guess we're going to expand so much. And of course, it's only for
Right now, it's the eyes and values. And I'm absolutely all for any idea.